When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured. Not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Get in zone, AutoZone.
Welcome to AutoZone. What are you working on today?
My check engine light's on.
That could hurt your gas mileage. The AutoZone free fix finder service can help find the fix for free.
Get in zone.
This whole report for free?
That's right. Printed and on your phone for free.
Get in zone.
But what if the fix is too tough?
We'll recommend a local shop. Fix Finder, only at AutoZone.
Get in zone, AutoZone.
Restrictions apply.
Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says they're terribly, terribly, terribly moody of human behavior. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And today, we are embarking on part two of a two-part podcast. So if you have not heard part one, the one that came out just previous to this one, you should probably go back and listen to that first.
Yeah.
Because that was part one of our podcast about mind control.
Right. And that one we really focused on propaganda and the way of presenting information, not just propaganda, but also advertising.
Mm-hmm.
And how the presentation of information can help at least nudge behavior in the way that you might want it to go.
Right.
Absolutely. Although in the past, all of that was done via traditional media, as we would call it today. Print and cartoons and movies and television, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it was true, done by traditional media. It was also done, I think, a lot of times with a kind of more intuitive methodology, though you certainly had people like Edward Bernays, who we talked about in the last episode, who applied some kind of scientific ways of studying how to change people's minds en masse.
Right.
But today we want to talk about a more more modern scientific technological approach to the ways different people are looking at changing human thought and behavior.
Right.
And whether that's ever the right thing to do, whether and to what extent it's possible to do. So, yeah, what's going on today in the world of changing how people think and behave?
And, you know, there are a lot of different reasons you might want to do this, right? There might be reasons to try and – you're trying to find the best way to, say, design a community so that people are generally happy there.
Like, sure.
It doesn't necessarily have to be anything kind of sinister going on, although that also is something we always have to keep in mind, because you're talking about – manipulating human behavior. And also it could easily be something that we seek out for ourselves, something that we want to change one of the behaviors we have, either enhance something that we already do or stop doing something that we don't want to do anymore. And then you wouldn't argue that it was sinister. It might be seen under the umbrella of self-improvement. But those same principles might be applied to a more broad audience than just a one-on-one kind of thing.
Certainly.
Sure. I mean, there are a million different ways we try to influence the ways other people think and behave, and not all of them are bad, certainly.
Yeah.
I mean, you have advertisers and propagandists, people trying to support their own interests
right.
by working on your brain. But then there's also, like, I mean, just think about every relationship you have with people that you love and care about. You do, in those relationships, do some work trying to make sure that those people keep liking you.
Yeah, sure. Or even, you know, display behaviors that are important to you, like not hooking themselves on meth, or like actually doing the dishes, or
wow.
like taking you out to dinner.
That's a heck
I know,
of
I,
a trio there, Lauren.
Those are the three things that I look for in all of my relationships.
Well, I was about
dinner,
to
no meth, and dish doing.
I was
indeed.
Gonna see. I was gonna say that at our old office location, I would occasionally walk across the street and purchase a dozen or so miniature cupcakes, and then distribute
yes.
them about the office whenever I felt that public opinion of Jonathan Strickland was falling below the necessary threshold.
Yeah, a very crude form of mind control.
It's, that was delicious propaganda.
Problematic now that we have moved our office and we're no longer close to Highland Bakery.
But there's a grocery right across the street.
I know, but that's a grocery. It's not a bakery.
They
I'm
have
still
a bakery
looking.
In the grocery. Anyway,
well,
so.
Well, yeah. So today I think we wanted to look at some of the modern methods.
Right.
And
right.
one of the first things that came up, I had never heard of this before we started doing research for this episode, but it's a concept known as persuasive technology.
And that's the concept of using technology, be it traditional media or the internets or gadgets or user experience within applications and all of that kind of stuff to, and I quote here, change users' attitudes or behaviors through persuasion and social influence, but not through coercion or deception. That is a quote from a call for papers from a 2014 conference on persuasive technologies.
Right.
Okay, so it's not trying to deceive you or bully you or
right.
something like that. But
hypothetically.
It is, but it is trying to use these methods to affect the way your brain works, to change
sure.
your habits or your opinions or your emotions.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And the study of computers specifically as persuasive technology was basically pioneered by one B.J. Fogg. And I love that Fogg is the last name of a dude who's clarifying things for all of us.
It's Fogg with two G's.
Right. Yeah. Sure. No, that's completely scientifically accurate. Yeah, it is Fogg with two G's, but I'm just saying. He in fact coined a term for the study of computers as persuasive technology, which is captology, and founded a persuasive tech lab at Stanford way back in 1998.
And from the website of that lab, and this sounds like it could have come from one of the science fiction novels we talked about in our first episode on this subject, that it says the best design solutions today change human behavior, yet despite decades of research, challenges remain for people who design to influence. And first, persuasion seems a dirty word. It shouldn't be. We should now embrace that we're in the business of behavior change. Next problem, conceptual confusion. The landscape of persuasion can be disorienting, muddied by impractical theories and overhyped techniques. Our new work provides a clear view of behavior change, including language that is simple yet accurate. So, the messaging here seems like that kind of, like, you could easily apply kind of a sinister undertone, but it's not. It's definitely not, because the word persuasion definitely has, you know, its own baggage that we associate
yeah,
with that word.
Like I said earlier, we're all trying to persuade in various ways all the time.
Now, I went ahead and searched through this website and played around with stuff. And honestly, I think that the approach is kind of cool. They've identified sort of a streamlined way of identifying behaviors that either you want to encourage or discourage, and how to go about doing that, whether it is something you are trying to do on a personal goal level, like, you know, the example they use often is exercise customize more.
Sure.
Or if it's something that you want to do when you are designing a product and you want people to use the product and to gain satisfaction from that product, you want to make sure you've designed it and marketed it properly so that people, when they purchase it, are happy with that. Because word of mouth is going to get you more sales. And also just generally, like, if you have a goal that your product is supposed to do a thing, here are the steps you need to make sure you follow in order for it to actually do that thing. So I think in the terms of something like the Wii game console, mm-hmm. that was one of those things that took off really quickly. And I think part of it was that Nintendo had done such a great job of presenting it as an alternative to the consoles that were putting in a lot of focus on high-end graphics and high-end processing power.
Yeah, those things were seen as sort of like the hot rods for gamers,
right.
Whereas the Wii became something for your family.
Yeah, that was exactly how they positioned themselves, and it worked like gangbusters. Mm-hmm. You couldn't find a Wii for the longest time. Now, you could look at Nintendo and say, well, the Wii eventually fell out of favor, but I would argue that was not because of the way they positioned themselves, but rather that there was a lack of supportive games there that people wanted to continue playing, and that ultimately there weren't enough people who were leveraging the control system for the Wii from a developer standpoint, probably because it's pretty difficult to develop for that kind of thing. And that was the downfall, not the initial positioning, which worked great. At any rate, the Persuasive Technologies Lab had created a roadmap called the Behavior Wizard.
So Behavior Wizard?
Yeah, I think of it kind of like those Microsoft wizards, like, I see you're making a document. Clippy would pop up. But
no.
It's not nearly – no, Clippy does not pop up.
Wouldn't it be great if you had a Clippy for your brain, though?
No.
Look, I already hate myself enough, dude.
It would be like a cortex, like Cordy. Pops up. Yeah. Hey, I see that you're trying to change your behaviors.
I think
would
I would
you
just
like
have,
some help with just, habit control?
I would just have a reptile brain pop up and say, run now.
Yeah.
At any rate.
Eat cake.
It would definitely be up there. So here's how BJ Fogg says this persuasive technology, the captology, can be effective, how it actually works. First, he says that you have to keep three things really in mind whenever you are trying to change behaviors. And the first is something I touched on in our previous episode, that simplicity is important when you design systems meant to change behavior because human beings are, in general, lazy.
Yeah.
So you got to make it easy to do.
Yeah.
If you don't make it, if it takes effort to do, the more effort it takes, the less likely that behavior is going to change.
And this isn't like an insult to us. I mean, another way to phrase human beings are lazy would be to say you don't want to waste your time.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. If you say the harder something is, the more you have to invest in order to really change that behavior. So the goal is make it as easy as possible. And the easier you make it, the more likely change will actually happen. So
right.
That's another way of looking at it. But they sum it up by saying, you guys are lazy. The second thing to keep in mind is that you should employ triggers, which are prompts or cues or calls to action, that kind of thing. And Dr. Fogg's behavior model identifies three types of triggers. You have facilitators, sparks, and signals. And the difference between the types fall on...
I love
on,
those names.
They are great, right? The differences fall on their scale of motivation versus ability. So motivation is the will to do something, and ability is the skill to do that thing. And he also points out that daily habits are the most powerful of all behaviors, and only by understanding those can you ever hope to change them, because it requires a long-term approach to behavioral change and a lot of different approaches to alter long-term behaviors don't take that into account. So an example of this might be you want to stop smoking, and a lot of approaches may have it be kind of a quit and you're done sort of thing, but that means you end up very often going back to that habit after some given amount of time, and that you really have to invest in this long-term view if you want to change a daily habit.
Okay, where does Clippy come in?
Clippy does not come in at all.
You spoke of the behavior wizard.
Yes, but Clippy is not a part of the behavior wizard. Clippy is probably a great way of convincing you not to use that version of Microsoft Office. So,
if that was the intended purpose, then
success, right?
Yeah, powerful mind control.
So the behavior wizard itself is a map that guides you into ways to change behaviors. And I actually went ahead and walked through this once just to see how it would work out. And I used an example of exercise for myself. It gives you a very simple choice at the very beginning, which is, do you want to stop or decrease a particular behavior, or do you want to start or increase a behavior? And I said I wanted to start or increase because I wanted to exercise more and more frequently. So after choosing start, I'm given three options, which is to restart a familiar behavior, so something I used to do but no longer do, start a brand new behavior, or increase an existing behavior. So I'm already walking to work, to and from work. That's about 6 miles every day. And I say I want to increase this behavior because while walking is good, I'm not really doing any other exercise.
Mm-hmm.
Next, it's asking me to define a time frame of how long I want this behavior to go on. I don't actually have to say what the behavior is at any point, by the way. You can just keep that in your mind, whatever mm-hmm. it may be. So in this case, I'm asked to define it as either a one-time thing, so I need to do this the one and only time and then I'm done, or for a period of time, like, you know, a certain set of months or years or whatever.
Working up to your wedding or swimsuit season or something
right,
like that.
Right, right, where there is a definitive endpoint, mm-hmm. or just from now on. Now, I want to do from now on because I want to have a healthy lifestyle until I'm no longer living. So that was why I would choose that one.
After you're no longer living, it's going to be Fritos and pigskins forever.
I guess technically I could have said for a period of time. That time being when I'm no longer breathing, but, you know, whatever.
No. For now on, yes.
So next, that gives me a pathway to follow, and they color code their pathways. It put me on the purple path because I wish to create a long-term increase in an existing behavior. So the other pathways included green, which is to do a new behavior, blue, to do a familiar behavior that you have stopped doing, a gray path, which was to decrease a behavior, or black path, which is to completely stop a behavior. And each path has its own requirements to achieve success. So the purple path requires me to change at least one element from the fog behavioral model. And here are the three elements they list. Increase the number of triggers that lead to a desirable behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So in whichever format of those triggers, I would use those to help encourage me to pursue this. Enhance my ability to perform that behavior. In other words, make it easier for me to do whatever that thing is. This might involve looking for a gym that's really close to my house, so it makes it a lot easier for me to get there and do this sort of thing. Or amplify the motivation for doing the behavior with intrinsic and extrinsic motivators. So intrinsic obviously would be things within myself. Extrinsic, I'd be telling my friends, hey, could you remind me to stop being such a, you know, lazy fat guy? And then that would help me motivate me to go and decrease my lazy fat guy-ness.
For example, making a pact amongst your friends like, hey, the next time that we get together and watch some movies, let's all bring vegetables instead of tortilla chips.
Or even, I have several friends.
I brought turnips.
Turnips.
We eat nothing.
As an example,
sorry, I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. I've got several friends who just this past weekend
brought turnips to your house.
No, they all participated in a color run.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, it's a fun group event where they're all exercising. I did not participate in this, although I did do quite a bit of walking this past weekend. But this would be an example of something that could be an extrinsic motivator. It's the participation of a social event that is completely centered around what I want to do, in this case, exercise. So none of this is sinister. This is all just – this is the way kind of setting yourself up for success, right? So once upon a time, the Persuasive Technology Lab sold resource guides to help people follow those pathways. But as of now, 2015, they say, well, the lab guides were created in 2010 and they weren't really – they haven't been updated in a while, so we're no longer selling them. If you are interested in this, you can actually contact them and explain what the behavior is you're trying to either increase or decrease or start or finish or whatever. And the lab may be able to share with you one of the guides that would be applicable to that. They might not, but they may.
So this is interesting because this seems largely, as you've described it, a sort of a self-applied and self-motivated way of changing thoughts and behaviors.
It can
especially
be,
changing behaviors.
Yeah.
And I wonder how well techniques like this or even other techniques in the persuasive technology field could be applied to others, which is what we think of more often in the mind control domain.
Well, even in this case, whereas I was using an example that was very much self, if you were using the same general kind of approach while designing whatever it is you are creating in order to put it forth into the public, mm-hmm. then the idea is that you would follow the same general pathway. You know, you would identify what it is your product is trying to do, whether it's trying to enhance a particular behavior or discourage it or whatever, and make sure that your design falls in line with the same sort of approach.
Right. For example, let's say that you're creating an app maybe that does motivate people to get fit.
Yeah, like Couch to 5K.
Sure. You know, if your app has a really bad design, like if it's difficult to use, then
if it's not using appropriate triggers,
right, you know, then it's not going to be successful in helping people do this thing, Couch to 5K.
And ultimately, people won't use it, which means ultimately the people who develop the app don't benefit from it. Mm-hmm. So there are ways of using this in a broader sense. And it's I've really focused on just this lab, it goes well beyond one lab.
Oh, yeah. Like I said at the top of this section, there are conferences, yearly conferences dedicated to this whole field of research. And for example, in 2014, the conference's focus was on bringing together workers in the fields of human-computer interaction and persuasive technologies, with the idea being that, you know, persuasive technology researchers are really steeped in the psychology of persuasion, which has only recently expanded to include interactive technologies. You know, previously it was the print, the radio, the TV, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, meanwhile, human-computer interaction researchers are chock full of knowledge about interactive usability and accessibility and experience, but might be less familiar with the psychological persuasion side. In 2013, the focus was on mobile apps. So
again, we can see this kind of work, this kind of research find its way into realms that will ultimately impact us as consumers mm-hmm. of either products or services.
Yeah. So there are, I'm sure, lots of things that we could learn that would be interesting about the way different user interfaces and apps and pieces of technology change our behaviors. Mm-hmm. I would love to see just this may exist, I don't even know, like an essay on the psychological effect in the long term of the like button.
Sure.
What does that do to us?
I am creeped out by the potential of that essay. I would love to read it. Or even just a essay on how successful Amazon's one-click button is.
Oh, yeah, yeah, to increase the behavior of impulse buying. Mm-hmm. Sure.
You guys have seen that Amazon has launched a new thing where for certain brands where it's a button that you connect to your Wi-Fi, a physical button that you connect to your Wi-Fi network. So you get a little plastic piece that's got a button on it, connected to a specific brand for a specific product. And then if you push the button, it automatically puts in an order of that product through Amazon. And that's all you have to do. You just push the button and then they send the thing to you. So, for example, it could be
like if you bump the box, you...
Well, if you...
You get a deluge of toilet paper.
Two things. One, as soon as the... it's each for one brand, right? So there's that. You're not going to get everything out of Amazon's catalog. But yeah, you could end up with like a whole bunch of toilet paper if you're not careful. Except that it also has
like
a thing where...
The Totino's Pizza Rolls button is stuck in the on position.
It also has a thing where you will not get... they will not send you another order until the first order that you've requested has arrived at your house.
That's good. That's
so
clever.
So you have like
a little bit of a buffer.
Yeah, you got a little kid visiting your house and they come up to the button and just start whacking away. You're just going to get one of those. So as long as you don't have something like a private jet button where you're going to be like, well, I wasn't planning on buying two private jets this month.
Yeah.
You should be all right.
Or it's not like a pet snake button or something.
It's usually, it's very specific stuff. So like paper towels or dishwasher fluid, that kind of stuff.
I use so much dishwasher fluid, I need a button for it.
Well, it's just one of of those things where you realize when you're running low, you just press the button and then you don't have to worry about it again.
Okay.
And for some things like paper towels, as a puppy owner right now,
mm-hmm.
that would come in incredibly handy when I'm coming down to that last roll. I'm like, let's just hit that button right now.
Okay. Well, we don't have to talk all user experience and technology, because in fact, there's a lot of science informing things that go way deeper into the human experience.
Sure.
That can change the ways that we think and behave. In fact, one of the main ones that I've always heard about in my life is colors.
Yeah, color psychology. I don't know how big this was when you guys were kids. When I was a kid, there was this whole thing about, you know, what's the best kind of way to create colors in the elementary school classrooms for a learning environment,
yeah,
that kind
sure.
of stuff.
Yeah.
And there have been a lot of studies on color psychology, what kind of colors might affect human behavior and decision making and our ability to learn, that sort of stuff. And some of the studies are really interesting, although there's a question about how much of it what are the methodologies behind it? There have been a lot of questionable methodologies over the years. But one of the studies I read about was that the color red might help athletes beat the snot out of each other.
Oh, well, that's nice.
Yeah. Scientific American had a study or an article that talked about a study conducted by anthropologists at Durham University. And the study had athletes who were participating in combat sports like boxing and Greco-Roman wrestling and Taekwondo pitted against one another, and some of the athletes were wearing outfits that were red and some were wearing outfits that were blue. And they saw that the people who wore red were winning more frequently than the ones who wore blue, particularly whenever you were looking at a scenario where the two opponents were really well matched, that their skill level was considered to be very close in range. So, in other words, if you put a novice in red against a Taekwondo master or just in blue, that novice is probably not going to take down the master. But if you're talking about two people of comparable skill level, it seemed that the ones who were wearing red were winning more frequently. Now, why that's the case, that's still a valid question. We don't necessarily know the answer. It could be that the ones who are wearing red were suddenly becoming more aggressive and taking more chances and were thus ending up, you know, with that great risk and great reward. It could be that the ones who are wearing blue were becoming more defensive and were not striking as frequently as the ones wearing red and therefore ended up ultimately losing. It could be that the referees were favoring those wearing red over those wearing blue. It could be a combination of these factors. We don't – the study did not go so far as to identify specifically why the ones in red were coming out on top more frequently. But there are other examples too. There are examples about colors affecting our purchasing decisions.
Hmm.
I mean, there are entire departments, obviously.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
In companies that are dedicated. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, there are reasons why most detergents have orange and blue coloring on their labels. And it's because at some point someone did a study and said, these are power colors for power.
Yeah. And they get attention and people pay attention to them, as opposed to like the clear or the white detergent bottles that might be overlooked instead. So
yeah, I don't know if this is true. I remember hearing when I was younger that it was like McDonald's uses that red and yellow thing because it makes people hungry. That might be totally not true, but
it's very
well it's at some point someone decided red makes you hungry, and actually yellow usually makes you angry according to like classical color psychology.
They
so
also,
I'm not sure where the yellow comes in.
They also
in.
Look like ketchup and mustard, but I'm just saying it's a hamburger place that looks like ketchup and mustard. Anyway, so Virginia,
yeah, it looks like bizarre arched fries descending into an ocean of ketchup.
That's the way I eat them. So over at Virginia Tech's Pamplin College of Business, there were a series of studies that found that consumers reacted differently to products that were presented on a red background versus those that were presented on a blue background. And they responded differently in different scenarios. So in an auction scenario, for example, the consumers who saw a red background on the product tended to bid more aggressively than those who saw that same product on a blue background.
Huh.
However, in negotiation scenarios where you have someone, you know, already saying, here's how expensive this product's going to be, and then you as consumer are trying to bargain them down, They saw that people who saw that product on a red background were less likely to accept a higher payment price than those who saw the same product on a blue background.
Huh. So it's like the red just generally made them more active in the bargaining either way.
Yeah.
Like it wasn't so much about the price point, but in like their level of participation.
Yeah, kind of. It is kind of weird because you could think that if you had presented this one product as an auction, the person seeing red was going to bid higher. If you presented it as a negotiation, they were going to demand it be lower in price. But it could be the exact same product with the red background, just two different scenarios.
Some research that I ran into would probably say that that was due to agitation. But I'll get to that in just a moment.
Yeah. All that being said, color psychology is still a field that's under a lot of study. Like I had mentioned before, methodologies are an issue, particularly with earlier studies, especially the ones that were dating out of the 1950s when this was starting to explode as a field of study.
Yeah, well, I'm sure this applies to a lot of the science we're going to be talking about in this episode because it's dealing with that kind of like behavioral conditioning.
And sure.
In these cases, I think a lot of times these studies they're not reproducible.
Right.
Yeah.
We don't know.
And furthermore, anytime that you're trying to really suss out the reasons for human behavior, there are so many factors at work there.
Sure. Yeah. And also just the idea that a lot of these studies get communicated to us through various forms of the media that may be oversimplifying or for multiple
or
reasons.
Overstating the significance of an
exactly.
observed effect. Like it might be that people with a red background are 5% more likely to do something than with another color.
Right.
And it's like, wow, look at that.
Right.
More likely.
And unless you're able to isolate all the other variables, like Lauren was saying, it's really hard to make a definitive conclusion. But there are other stimuli that could potentially alter our moods to the point where our decision making is in fact affected.
Yeah.
Like sound. Like if you are tired of my voice, you may want to strangle somebody. That would be altering your decision making process, I'm sure. Unless you had already planned to do that, in which case, don't do that.
I'm sure you could devise a pretty effective mind control method for me that would just make me want to get out of a place that had the fluorescent light buzzing.
Oh, yeah.
That's fair. So I read a piece in Psychology Today. It was published way back in 1981 that looked at the effect of sounds in urban environments on the mental health of people who live there, or you know how they perceived sound and noise. So the beginning of the article described a very simple experiment in which a researcher was carrying several volumes of books down a sidewalk and then would drop some of those books as if it was just an accident, like tripping and dropping a couple of books. And they also had, during various trials of this experiment, a lawnmower that was either running, so the lawnmower motor was making noise, or it was not running. And they found that 50% of the time when the researcher, quote unquote, accidentally dropped books, but the lawnmower wasn't running, people would come to help the researcher to pick up the books.
Okay.
So half the time when the lawnmower wasn't running, someone would come and help out. But if the lawnmower was running, only 12.5% of the time would someone
wow.
come to help them. So if this irritating noise was going, people were just like, no, I just want to get out of here and just keep on walking. Presumably that's what they were thinking. Obviously a study can't really find out what people are thinking yet because we haven't installed the necessary technology to read thoughts. So the piece then went on to explore how unwanted noise and the way we perceive it can affect our mental health. And in general, unwanted noise can cause things like stress, anxiety, irritation, sleep deprivation, that sort of stuff, factors that can influence our decision-making processes. But just like we were talking with color, we don't know to what extent this can affect us. It clearly does affect us.
Mm-hmm.
But does it affect us to a point that we are making decisions based mainly on that? Probably not. It is one of many factors.
And with all of these questions about whether it's user experience in an app or color or sound, to what extent could these things be used with precision
right.
by someone trying to get a particular result out of your brain?
Right. Like, could I have someone orchestrate a situation where I walk into a red noisy room and that makes me do what they want me to do. Probably
right.
not.
Sure.
And Joe, you and I even talked about something like this, about the wind turbines, about how people who have perceived a low level noise from wind turbines say it's negatively impacting their lives and therefore they don't want wind turbines installed near their neighborhoods. So this is a real thing that really does real in the sense that it's really affecting people, whether it's physically affecting them in the way.
Yeah. Right. Another real thing that really does work and is manipulatable is scent.
Oh, yeah. So funny story. We got our idea to do this whole podcast about various methods of subtle and explicit mind control.
Yeah.
After we did an episode about the future of smells and how we learned that there is at least some amount of research suggesting that certain smells change the way we act in certain scenarios.
And the way we perceive things as well.
Yeah.
And that it can be a subliminal smell. It can be below our threshold of detection and yet still have an effect. So, for example, one of the studies we talked about involved people looking at a series of different photographs of people having kind of a neutral expression on their faces. But the control group was just in a room looking at pictures, and the experimental group was in a room looking at pictures, but the room had a subliminal level scent of, I think it was a floral scent, a pleasant floral scent. And that the ones who were in the room that had the floral scent ended up saying that more of the faces looked likable than the control group did. And so it suggests that when we are subjected to this kind of stimuli, our perception can be somewhat nudged, not necessarily to the point where we're going to make a completely new decision, but we might have a different first impression. We may have a different emotional association with whatever that situation happens to be. So if the first time you ever encountered something was accompanied by a really unpleasant scent, you may have an unpleasant association with whatever that thing is.
Mm-hmm.
So, which, again, it's not like mind-blowing revelation, but it is interesting that the smell does not have to be at a detectable
perceptible
level.
Right. Yeah. That was the thing that totally blew my mind.
That part was really, how do you control for that? So now we're talking about if someone can get me into a red noisy room that smells like
very faintly of jasmine.
There you go. Could they get me to do what they want me to do? And again, probably not. Unless it's just like, do you want to leave the room? And I'm like, well, if this is all it is a red noisy room, then yeah, I want to go.
You know, you're saying you're not likely to encounter this scenario because you're picturing it as a physical location. Like somebody getting you to go into a red noisy room with a certain smell. But I think that there is much more potential for using these kinds of factors to influence us when we imagine them coming in digital form.
Okay.
So instead, think about the way you are sort of living in your computer for a lot of the time.
Okay.
You know, what you're looking at, your entire world is what's on your computer screen. You've got your headphones on. That's what you're hearing.
This is really... Sorry to sound really sad. And
well, no,
unfortunately, very true.
We all become immersed in our devices sometimes.
Sure.
And that can be, in a lot of ways, kind of like going into a room where somebody gets to control all the environmental conditions. They're controlling what you hear, what you see, what the colors are. If you buy that that smell-o-rama kind of stuff we talked about in the Future of Smells episode, there may even be digital ways of influencing and introducing scents into your environment.
Mm-hmm.
So I can see this being sort of like an electronically deliverable environment that can be controlled to influence your behavior and thoughts.
Yeah, it may be something a little more simple, like here is a virtual experience that is meant to help you relieve anxiety and stress. Like that I could easily see.
Yeah.
But as opposed to something like, here's an experience that you are unaware is attempting to affect your behavior to certain ends, I'm not entirely certain that would work.
That happens all the time. Every single time that you walk into a store or a restaurant, you are entering an environment that has been created specifically to get you to do certain things.
Sure.
And that's usually buy more stuff.
Yeah.
And a whole lot of research has gone into this field. It's called environmental psychology. It includes the music, the color, the scent. And again, a caveat, like I said before, there are so many variables that go into any individual person's decisions to stay in a place and make purchases there. So it's really hard to assign any of these individual stimuli the responsibility of driving a customer's behavior.
Mm-hmm.
But when discussing environmental psychology, lots of researchers depend upon a model that was created by Mehrabian and Russell in 1974, and that is pleasure arousal dominance.
What?
And that's not some weird 50 Shades of Grey thing. That is a 3D graph of feeling pleasure versus displeasure, aroused versus calm, and in control versus controlled. Okay. Now that second vector, aroused versus calm, or agitated versus calm, as I said earlier in this episode, is what gives a lot of researchers fits, because some research indicates that across the board, people make more snap purchases when they're aroused, when there's loud music or bright colors or something like that. But some research indicates that people make more purchases overall when they're calm because they're more likely to stay in a place longer. But, you know, if we go with the music example, what types of music lead to those feelings? In one study that was published in Advances in Consumer Research in 1993, they found that playing popular music, arousing music, basically, boosted sales that were made to younger men. But playing instrumental music, calming music, boosted sales made to older women.
Huh.
But there's still a lot of questions to be asked. You know, was the music familiar or unfamiliar to the people? Hypothetically, familiar music is more arousing. Hypothetically,
right.
if you're listening to unfamiliar music and going like, "What is that music about? Let me look it up on my phone," that can lead to a higher state of arousal. How loud was the music? Had the customers just gone through a breakup and listened to a lot of Taylor Swift, and was Taylor Swift playing? And did that motivate them to buy more or less? It's hard to say.
That makes me think about the potential for personalized advertising, like with incorporating these environmental kind of factors. Then again, I don't know how that would really happen for like an online shopping experience. I mean, you don't want to go to an online shopping destination and have it start playing music at you. You'd turn it off.
I don't want to go anywhere and have it play music at me unless I have chosen to listen to music.
Right.
Yeah, no. And but, that's my immediate, like, where is the mute button on my computer reaction whenever I encounter that.
Sure. But there are some online shops, usually like private boutique kind of shops, that will have... And if they're clever, they'll have a little button that says, "Would you like to play the accompanying music?"
Yeah.
And that will give you some stuff to listen to while you're buying lots of things.
Who on earth clicks yes?
Sometimes out of curiosity, I'm like, I do want to know what they want me to listen to right now. That sounds horrifying.
Yeah,
that's kind of interesting, I guess. A little tidbit out there for restaurant owners who have websites. Don't have your website autoplay music. It doesn't make me want to eat your food more.
However, in fact, just go to the Oatmeal and read their webcomic about what not to do when you're a restaurant website, because that just really sums it up.
Have the hours of operation on every page.
Yes. Please.
And make sure your menu is up to date. Those are my two big ones.
And post your address. Just post your address.
Yeah, that's a good one too.
Please.
Yeah, but hours of operation, don't put it on contact. That doesn't make any sense. All right, I think I've gone off on a tangent. I need to calm down. So I'm just going to take my meds here. You talk about the next thing, Jeff.
No, hold on a second.
What?
That was a blatant transition.
Well,
I just caught you in a segue.
It wouldn't have been blatant if you hadn't pointed it out.
Okay, let's talk about drugs.
Okay.
Because it is no secret at all that drugs can affect your behavior.
That is the purpose of some of them, yes.
Yeah. But the question is about the level of precision with which people could intentionally use drugs to modify their own behavior or the behavior of others.
Mm-hmm.
So we're familiar with, for example, psychopharmacological drugs, the drugs we take to help us with like subjective mental states.
Sure.
Or just an example would be antidepressants.
Yeah.
Or anti-anxiety medication.
Sure.
Or something like that. It causes changes in your brain chemistry that translate into changes in subjective experience and behavior. But research is showing that some particular drugs can have an influence on not just that, but on people's ethical decision making. So not just how they feel, their internal states, but how they make decisions and what their values are and what they do. So in the scholarly literature, using scientific or technological methods to induce a change, hopefully for the better, in one's ethical tendencies or capacities is known as moral enhancement. And there's a lot of debate among like philosophers and ethicists about, you know, what does it really mean to say that we could use external, you know, methods and drugs and surgeries and brain stimulation and things like that to change our morals? What would that does that action actually have a moral quality to it?
Mm-hmm.
Like, is it moral to take a pill that you think would make yourself more moral?
See, well, I mean, that's a philosophical argument that we could actually have right now. Well,
let's get into that in a minute. Because first I should talk about the fact that this actually seems very likely to be possible.
Mm-hmm.
Just a few examples of chemicals that could potentially change moral or social behavior. One is oxytocin. That's a naturally occurring hormone. So there's already oxytocin in your body.
Mm-hmm.
And it's associated with a wide range of effects in the brain, mostly centered around like intimacy and bonding, kind of hugging, cuddling, happy times chemicals. So the release of oxytocin is triggered in maternal infant bonding behaviors. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, you can probably guess that it's been named as a potential candidate for chemical moral enhancement. And if we discover, for example, that taking a nasal spray dose of oxytocin makes people more empathetic, increases nurturing behaviors, encourages trust, and cuts down on anxiety, why wouldn't we want to live in a world where everybody sort of hits a squirt of oxytocin before coming into the office in the morning? Like, it's just a spray of cuddle juice.
I don't know. I sit between Josh and Chuck, and I'm not sure I want to get cuddled.
But then it's funny because oxytocin is kind of a flagship for the complications that exist now with our incomplete understanding of how drugs affect our moral and ethical decision making.
Mm-hmm.
Because on the one hand, it does seem to have this effect, like it encourages these positive pro-social emotions like trust and bonding. But at the same time, it may come with its own problems. For example, I've seen reports suggesting that in addition to all the positive traits, oxytocin might be associated with increased ethnocentrism, in-group loyalty, out-group suspicion. The idea is that it might encourage sort of lots of good pro-social qualities for the close inner circle of people at the expense of relationships with strangers and people perceived to be outside the inner circle.
This is fascinating to me. It kind of makes me think of primitive cultures that were, you know, in fairly close proximity with one another, where you study the language of those cultures, and often the word that they give for themselves tends to mean the people, and the word that they give for other cultures that are within the proximity tends to be something like those heathens over there, or those folks that we don't like to talk about, that kind of thing.
And
it sounds like this is kind of instilling that, or potentially could be, you know, kind of giving those sort of same feelings that we witness in primitive cultures.
Right. Well, part of the thing is we just don't know the full range of effects yet, because, you know, these relationships between our total sort of profile of behavior and single chemicals and how they act on the brain is very complex and difficult to understand.
Oh, of course. Although, you know, with this particular example, we know that this is a hormone that does stuff in our body, that does brain stuff in our body in these ways. But what about drugs that aren't necessarily intended to do brain stuff in our body?
Yeah, we've actually discovered that some drugs already used for other purposes have a side effect of having implications for our moral and ethical decisions and behaviors. For example, one thing that people talk about is SSRIs taken for various reasons can help change the way people look at certain moral dilemmas. And then here's a big one. What about a drug to reduce racism?
They have a drug for that?
Well, I mean, we have a drug where there's a suggested link. So there's a drug called propranolol.
Okay.
That's used as a beta blocker for people with like cardiovascular conditions. So if you have high blood pressure or heart disease, you might take propranolol to relax your circulatory system and decrease your blood pressure. Well, a study published in Psychopharmacology in 2012 found that one side effect of this drug is that it seems to reduce people's implicit negative racial bias.
Huh.
So in a double-blind test environment, 36 white volunteers were randomized, divided into groups, and the test group was given a single 40-milligram dose of propranolol, and then there was, of course, a placebo-controlled group. And the participants were given tests of both their explicit levels of racial prejudice, like, you know, what they would report, and then also a racial implicit association test. It's sort of this thing to find out what your unconscious racial biases are. Mm. And the authors reported, quote, relative to placebo, propranolol significantly lowered heart rate and abolished implicit racial bias without affecting the measure of explicit racial prejudice. Propranolol did not affect subjective mood.
Huh.
So
that's really interesting. And the difference between what people think they're doing and what they actually are doing is a factor that's been studied in a lot of these fields that we're talking about.
Yeah. And so this was a small study, and the authors themselves call out for more researchers to try to find
36
similar results.
Is
yeah.
Nothing.
So they ask, you know, please more people try to replicate this and see what you come up with. But whether or not this particular drug or any of its family can actually make us less racist, just the possibility of such a chemical is really worth talking about, because in my mind, the fact that most people who exhibit racist behavior claim not to be racist when you call them out for it signals, to me at least, that I think most people, even most fairly racist people, recognize that racial bias is generally a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
And many would be willing to take a pill to reduce their own racial bias if they could.
Maybe.
One would hope so.
At worst, I would hope that they would say, well, this isn't going to do anything because I'm not racist.
Oh, they might as well, you know, can't hurt to take it, right?
Yeah, as long as it was something where, like, what are the side effects? Oh, there are no side effects. Well, then you're fine.
Well, yeah, and I'm not advising everybody to go out and take
beta blockers.
No. I don't need, yeah, that's obviously we are not telling people to start taking heart disease medication.
No.
But
certainly
there
not
may
randomly
be,
on the black market. No.
Right. So there may be other drugs that have similar effects that don't have side effects.
You know,
we don't know yet. But the fact that that's a possibility is very interesting, because it brings up the question of what is it ethical to try to get other people to do to change their behaviors? I mean, if it turned out that we discovered there was a pill and we tested it rigorously and said, you know, it looks like this pill has no negative side effects, except that it generally makes people have a little bit less anxiety and it decreases racial bias by 75%. Would that be a drug you could say, okay, everybody in society should take this?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, to me, the question of ethics really comes in the pursuit of using these techniques specifically to alter human behavior from like a study perspective, because I think implementation is always going to be problematic.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, if you are living in a culture where the good of the many outweighs the good of the few, and that's the accepted worldview for that culture, maybe then you would actually have this as a prescribed element where you had to take it because that's just culturally what people believed. But in other places, I think that would be problematic at best. To me, the two main factors that go into whether or not it's ethical to attempt to alter human behavior are intent and implementation. By that I mean, what is the purpose for attempting to change human behavior? If your intent is to make the environment a better place to live, and therefore people tend to make more quote unquote moral or ethical decisions because the environment they are in is a more pleasant environment, I see nothing wrong with that, because ultimately what you're saying is I'm trying to do my best to make this environment a good one for people. So in this case, I would say things like, when you're going in for redevelopment of urban landscapes that could potentially be good, although we also know there are big issues with that too. Like, you could end up driving prices up and then pushing people who could most benefit from that renewal outside of that area, which obviously we don't want to do that. You're defeating the purpose then. So it's a very delicate thing to do. That kind of leads into the implementation. How do you actually implement these things so that you're trying to change behavior? If you're doing it in a way where it's not invasive or intrusive, and you aren't, you know, trying to specifically herd people into a particular type of behavior, I don't have a whole lot of objections to it. Obviously, the more invasive or, unescapable you make this kind of implementation, the more I get really nervous about it. So those are the two factors to me that are the most important. And it's not like a binary system where one is good and one is bad. It's definitely several shades across the spectrum. And these various two factors can play very important roles in different ways.
Yeah, I think one of the main distinctions that is becoming quite obvious is people choosing behavior-changing stimulations and conditions to apply to themselves versus applying that to other people, like without their knowledge or without their consent. That's, of course, in the second condition where it becomes really difficult. I mean, I don't think anybody really has much of a problem with somebody choosing to use whatever kind of techniques or drugs or anything science can come up with to make themselves exercise more by their own choice, mm-hmm. or to make themselves have, you know, less racial bias, or to make themselves more generous. That all seems pretty fine, I think.
Most humans agree that that's a personal choice.
Yeah, and so, of course, we would probably also mostly agree that it's wrong to use techniques like this against other people's will to coerce them or to exploit them. But what about in these middle case scenarios where you are basically coercing people but for something that seems to be for the greater good? That's where it gets really sticky. Like, for example, there is talk of using a hypothetical aggression-reducing, impulsiveness-reducing drug as a cure for somebody convicted of a violent crime. Now, I have very little doubt that we could find several drugs in the future that would accomplish this goal. That doesn't seem implausible to me at all.
Okay.
But it's the ethical question. Is it an unacceptable violation of the freedom and the privacy of the accused? On one hand, my intuition sort of says, unequivocally, yes, you can't force people to take drugs that will change their personality.
This is getting back to A Clockwork Orange, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that seems very, very wrong. On the other hand, what do we do now to somebody who's convicted of a violent crime? Well, we lock them in a prison, or in some cases, like historically, or depending on where you are in the world, you might physically injure them or kill them or something.
Yeah, and then there's even in the prison scenario where rehabilitation is supposed to be a factor, in reality, that the rehabilitation effect doesn't seem to be taking high priority in a lot of cases.
Yeah, yeah. And so, I don't know. I mean, locking someone in a prison is not at all a nice thing to do to them. I mean, mm-hmm. most people accept that that's something you have to do, but it's sort of a necessary evil. So if someone's a murderer, they're a hitman for the mob or something, most people, I think, feel like it's okay to lock that person up somewhere where they can't hurt other people. So would it
for
really,
the greater good?
Yeah. So would it really be worse to offer that hitman instead the option of, say, a reduced sentence and the option of taking a drug that makes 75% of people in previous cases less likely to commit acts of violence in the future? It's a tough call because intuitively I still don't like it. It seems creepy. But then again, you know, that's my intuitions. If I went with my gut, I would be telling the Wright brothers that if man had been meant to fly, et cetera, you know, he'd been born with a aerodynamic hydrogen sack.
Well, and there's a historical case that we can point to immediately in the technology world where, you know, this very thing had been employed, and it wasn't for violence, but for homosexuality.
Yeah.
Turing was given the option to essentially
Alan Turing. We're
yes,
talking about
Turing, Alan
scientist.
Turing.
Yeah.
He was given the option to be chemically castrated, rather than be incarcerated for his homosexuality, which he opted to do. And then ultimately he would, well, depending upon the report, he committed suicide or was incredibly unfortunate in consuming too much arsenic from apple seeds.
I thought about that exact same comparison. The one thing that makes that very different than what we're talking about is that Turing was very obviously, I mean, at least to all us in the room, I think we would agree, the victim of a deeply unjust law.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. You know, and
it
also,
it wasn't like he actually did something deeply evil that.
Except again, it's all based upon whichever culture is imposing this, right? I mean, in our culture, obviously now we're having this change where people are more accepting of homosexuality, but
and
there
hooray
are,
for that, yes.
Which, yes, again, I agree, hooray for that. But there are other cultures where they might still very much consider it. In fact, there are other cultures where they very much consider it a crime.
Mm-hmm.
And so, it's one of those things that we do see this being employed right now. It's just not in the case of this pill will make you less violent.
Right. And of course, it is a different thing to say imprisonment versus chemical castration and imprisonment versus a really good drug that has no negative side effects that lets you be who you are, but 75% less violent.
Yeah, that is very different, obviously.
Those are, there are side effects to being chemically castrated and those are negative.
Yes, yeah, so that's true.
Yeah. And of course, I'm not going so far as to advocate the drug that would make somebody less violent. I'm saying it's a tough call. I don't know what we should do in that scenario.
Yeah.
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 Well, and if I may kind of devil's advocate, I would say that the question is nearly moot when you get right down to it, because although I do believe in the wonders of modern medicine continuing into the incredible future, psychology is not a science that can be applied evenly across a population. Even psychiatry is really a guessing game, certainly at our current level of knowledge, and I'm not sure that I can envision an immediate future in which we've gained enough new knowledge to make it so, you know. The human body and brain are so complex. There's so much going on with each individual person that any given method or drug is difficult to apply across an entire culture. But if I had to take a side, I guess I would say that, you know, I'd agree with you, Joe. Like, no, it's not ethical to ever try to change someone else's behavior. Probably. But sometimes factors more important than ethicality do influence our decisions.
Yeah. In the same way that it's also not ethical to lock somebody in a prison, you just might have to do it considering the alternative.
Well, and in my case, when I'm thinking about altering behavior, I think I'm looking at it a little less of an extreme case than what has been proposed here.
Right. I mean,
here.
Mostly we'd be talking about just changing day-to-day behaviors in mm-hmm. everybody.
Yeah, really what I'm thinking about is improving things, like demonstrably improving things like cleaning up environments, making places more pleasant to live and work in, that sort of stuff where – again, you're setting up a person for success. You're removing some of the negative things that could influence decision making to making choices that would harm yourself or others. Not that it eliminates it, but that it decreases some of the triggers, some of the motivations for that behavior. So, in other words, you're not so much trying to change someone's behavior as you are trying to make the environment as conducive to good behavior as possible.
Mm-hmm.
That's really the only way I would see it as being something I would accept personally.
Well, sure. And there could be other ways that there are things that have a big impact that really matters more so than just like, you know, can we convince people to buy more hamburgers or
sure.
something?
Mm-hmm.
But that aren't necessarily associated with like, here's a hitman for the mob who we're trying to reform with drugs or with a happy, you know, red room that plays good music or something. no, I mean, there can be things like public opinion. I mean, this sort of gets us back to the propaganda thing, but there are problems that almost everybody recognizes when faced with them explicitly in the ways we deal with public problems. For example, we just are not very good at long-term thinking.
No.
I mean, we live in like a, you know, in a, ostensibly a semi-properly functioning democracy where your vote has some kind of meaning, where you can vote on the issues that matter to you. But we're consistently not doing a great job of casting the kinds of votes that would be most beneficial to people in 100 years from now.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah. No, it's, everyone's more concerned about like what they're getting for lunch tomorrow than what their grandchildren will be getting for lunch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I don't know. I mean, that just kind of makes me think like, well, what if we found a drug that or a smell or something that makes
or chip
people,
in your brain.
Yeah. That makes people more likely to think long term instead of just about short term personal gains.
Well, all we have to do is find that secret to reversing aging, and then we will very much be concerned with long term.
I'm not sure we would, actually.
You think we would still be very short-term and just be like, wow, things sure are crappy now.
I think we care about ourselves tomorrow way more than we care about ourselves in 40 years.
I guess it depends. It's interesting. I mean, I probably would lean toward that at least for the, again, the short-term, but I think that would be something we would grow out of. Unfortunately, the question is whether we would grow out of it before it was too late to do anything about it. At any rate, we're also, you know, in the future, we're already talking about things like brain-computer interfaces that, I mean, there's some that already do exist that work on various levels that we've talked about in this podcast. And we've also mentioned the fact that this interaction doesn't just go from brain to computer. It can go from computer to brain.
Mm-hmm.
But as Lauren was saying, human brains, we're super complex and we barely know what's going on right now. Like we can have a very high level view of how the brain works. But when you get down to specifics, like can you make someone remember a specific memory or experience a specific thing? That gets a lot trickier.
There's a reason why when you read about the knowledge and the effects of neurochemicals and things like that today, you'll often see phrases like associated with.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Because like we have a very, very wide, I'd say, but also very loose understanding of what's going on inside the brain and how that correlates to subjective experience and behavior.
So now that knowledge is going to increase. It's going to continue to increase over time. And maybe someday it's possible that we'll come up with methods that could allow us to very specifically alter someone's views, perspectives, behaviors, experience, whatever. But that day is not really going to be close, right? It's going to be a far, it's 20 to 40 years, you think?
20 to 40 years. To 40 yeah, that's years. What I'd say. Yeah.
You know, it's weird that the singularity wore off, guys.
I
was really
know.
Strange.
Crazy.
But yeah, it's one of those things where maybe one day these sort of the real dystopian science fiction kind of views of the future will be closer to a potential reality. I mean, you might argue that we're there depending upon which dystopia you're looking at and how cynical you are. Now, my hope is that by continuing these kind of conversations and really just getting into the discussion of why this is so complicated beyond just ethics, but to biology as well, that we will get a better understanding, not just of how we work, but why we work the way we do. And this has been really fascinating to cover this pair of episodes about these topics. And, you know, the smell one, I think, was a nice way of leading us into this. And obviously, we could have done 5 or 6 or 10 more episodes that are based on this. We could have done deeper dives on these things. So if you guys out there were really fascinated by this and you want to hear more discussions or there's something specific you would like to hear more about, you should let us know. Or if you just have a suggestion for any sort of future episode, we're going to be doing some listener mail episodes very shortly. You can contact us. Our email address is fwthinking@howstuffworks.com or drop us a line on Facebook, Twitter, or Google Plus. At Twitter and Google Plus, we are fwthinking. Over on Facebook, just search fwthinking in the search bar will pop right up. Leave us a message, and we'll talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring? but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200K for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does all the work for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. Visit Picasso to see thousands of listings. That's PACASO.com.
We're all looking for ways to save, especially on medical bills. But where do you start? Unless you're a medical billing expert, finding savings can seem impossible. HealthLock can help. HealthLock is a healthcare technology company that securely connects with your insurance and flags errors like overbilling, wrong codes, and fraud. You can even have HealthLock work on your behalf to get money back from select past bills. Saving starts with knowing where to look. Visit HealthLock.com today before you see another healthcare provider.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.